Welcome back to the Don't Worry About It podcast, where we talk all things mental health related, from anxiety to depression, from happiness to sadness, and all emotions and feelings in between. My name is David Izzo, and I started this podcast to help facilitate conversations related to mental health topics. On this week's episode, I invited Dr. Gabriella Podolsky, PsyD, of Thriving Center of Psychology. Dr. Podolsky is a clinical psychologist who has experience working with individuals across all lifespans with a wide range of depression, anxiety, and trauma-related disorders, as well as relationship issues. I really wanted to have a chat with her and go into what makes a relationship, what goes into anxiety, effective communication, and a lot more. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Thanks so much for listening. Dr. Podolsky, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was really excited to have you on is because your social media is so awesome. Saw you on Instagram, you have like such creative posts, and I clicked, saw you're a clinical psychologist, and I haven't been able to have so many, you know, professionals on as I'd love to. So I'm really glad you're able to join us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I currently am a clinical psychologist, and I currently work in a private practice setting where I primarily work with young adults and adults primarily suffering from depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, various like relationship concerns, and I would say just general life stressors. So a higher functioning population in an outpatient setting. So that's primarily who I work with.
And you mentioned you work with young adults. One of the things you mentioned I'm super interested in is relationship work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Could you elaborate on what relationship work is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in kind of mentioning a little bit about what I do. So I tend to work with both individuals and couples in terms of relationships. And so, you know, a lot of the clients that I work with come in for relationship concerns. So whether that means on a dyadic level, so coming in for couples therapy, or on an individual level, just kind of, you know, working through their relationships with their partners, with their families, with their friends, or even on a personal level, kind of their relationship with themselves. I tend to work with clients on, you know, better understanding the dynamics within the relationships, getting to the heart and the root of the communication patterns that are within the relationships, helping them to really gain some insight into kind of what hasn't been working and, you know, the directions they can go in terms of like what would be more effective within the relationship.
And relationship work seems right. You can either have multiple parties, and there's so many different dynamics that go into it. What have been, in your professional experience, what are some of the bigger things that are going on that you've seen? Are there any trends, common themes that are affecting a lot of people?
You know, I would say it's actually interesting. I was just having a conversation regarding this today. So there's primarily within couples work, there's Dr. John and Julie Gottman do a lot of research within relationships and marital relationships. And it's something that was interesting that I actually saw today was that the primary issue that people fight about is nothing. And so it's not necessarily about like these big topics like, you know, finances or like in-law issues or stuff like that. It's actually about just this inability to connect with your partner. And that's really at the root of it. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily recognize that just focusing and honing in on their ability to connect with their partner is really at the root of it. And it's not so much about the ins and outs of what's going on or these specific arguments, more so about their ability to communicate effectively with one another, communicate their needs effectively, and to hear their partners and to feel present with their partners and really create that connection.
So it seems like a breakdown of communication seems to be the root.
I would say a lot of that. I mean, I often feel like within communication is that when it's ineffective, we're not really connecting with our partners. Whether that, again, I keep saying partners, it doesn't necessarily have to be a romantic partner. It could be a family member, a friend. But that inability to connect, I would say often is based on our inability to communicate our needs and to feel present with the person we're trying to communicate or connect with.
Is it possible that if you're not capable of, you know, connecting with yourself and understanding yourself, would that prevent you from being able to connect with others?
Oh, absolutely. That's a really good point. I think like something that I've actually spent a lot of time, researching, and I see on a very clinical level as well, is when we're better for ourselves, we're better for people around us, right? So I think oftentimes, our culture focuses on like giving and doing for others, right? And it's often perceived as like selfish to put ourselves first, right? And so we often don't focus on ourselves, when the reality is when we're more attuned to our own needs and when we put ourselves first, we're better for the people around us. So I always use kind of like the metaphor of, let's say like when you get on an airplane, right? They say, put your safety, your safety belt and your seatbelt on, or your provide the, what is it? The airbag for yourself first. And so that's the idea of like, when we need to tend to ourselves and we need to care for ourselves before we could be effective in caring for other people. And so I think that that's it's a really good point, because I think ultimately we need to kind of be more in touch with ourselves before we could kind of provide for others and show up for others in the way that we need to more effectively, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. Logically, it makes sense, right? To be, if you're going to be with yourself and with others, you need to be, take care of yourself and do what you need to do. That way you can be better for others. But unfortunately, human beings are not logical. We're emotional. We don't always do what's best for us. And we kind of, I think we have our culture, especially here in America, where we do for others before ourselves. And I think there's a lot of reasons behind it. I think we want to do for others because it's easier. It's a lot easier to help someone else than to do the work on yourself. You can kind of sell it as, if I'm doing something for others, I'm not selfish. I'm selfless. But so weird that those activities have branded themselves doing that.
I do think, I do think there is some idea around, like, again, it's perceived as selfish, but I firmly believe that it's actually the opposite. And that really plays into this idea of like self-care and the real need for it within our culture, right? We overwork, we undervalue kind of providing for ourselves, creating space for ourselves outside of our work and outside of providing for others. And when we can really invest in ourselves and engage in activities that nourish us and feed us, again, we're going to be better in so many other areas of our lives. And so it's actually counterproductive not to. Like, we think that, okay, we want to keep working and working and working. The reality is, if you just provide that sense of like self-care and you indulge a little bit in things that again, nourish you or feed you, you're going to be better in your work role. And the same thing within a parenting role or a friend role or a romantic partner. If you provide those spaces for yourself, you actually can show up a lot more effectively for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it must, as somebody who's a use case definitely for this, I have to say, I think there's also a toll on the mental bandwidth that human beings have that we're able to hold on to. If you're focusing all your time and energy on other people while also having your own issues, you don't have there's only so much of you that you have to give. So if you're giving it all to other people, there's not much space that's left over. And I think eventually when that catches up to you, I wonder if that's what's creating, we've had I don't even want to call it an outbreak, I think an awakening to so many mental health issues that are sweeping the nation. That have been going on for years. Anxiety cases, people who identify with anxiety or depression have skyrocketed, not only during COVID, but I wonder what other trends do you see, and what kind of work can be done to combat this on a personal level?
Well, I think what's interesting that you actually just brought up, right, is that we're seeing more of these things during COVID, right? So like, we're seeing heightened, let's say, anxiety or heightened depression, and a lot of it obviously seems fairly obvious, right? But there's an interesting point to it, that we have a lot more time and a lot fewer distractions. And that speaks this idea of like, we're in a go, go, go culture that's like, we don't provide for ourselves. So then when we actually stop, and there's so much space and so much time, it creates actually an increase in, let's say, like anxiety and depression, because now we're forced to sit with a lot of these discomforts and feelings that were there prior that we were just not giving the time and space to, right? So there's just a sense of like, is it heightened, or are we actually just now we're more aware because there's more, again, more space and more time, and there's a lot more silence, and people have a really hard time sitting in silence and sitting with their thoughts.
That's a really good point. It just made me realize, you know, if somebody asks me, or if you ask people what their most optimized efficient day is, and I'm sure a lot of people will say, I woke up early, I went to the gym, and then I went straight to work. I worked, had a great day at work, went home, cooked dinner, had spent time with friends. And none of those things ever say I spent time, you know. Some people may, a lot of people now will man meditation, but a lot of people wouldn't say, you know, I was present in these moments, or I was aware in these moments. And if your most optimized day is full of distraction, and like you said, you know, there's less noise now, that there's been more time than ever for people to have less of it, you know, and when there's nothing left, but when all the distractions kind of fade away, you're left with noise. And I think that is a really good point on why it's become so apparent to so many people. It's why I think it's been a sleeping giant. I don't think causes for anxiety have risen.
Yeah,
I believe it's
absolutely.
just more become an awareness.
Correct. And it's why it's like highlighting and really emphasizing issues that were already there. Like, it's not necessarily kind of like you're saying, it's not necessarily causing necessarily. It's bringing to light issues that were there that we were able to navigate. And now we're in a totally different type of environment, right? Our whole world shifted, and the way we operate and when we navigate our day to day, our environments shifted so vastly that now we're in this position that we have to kind of figure out how do we adjust to that? How do we address these issues that aren't so like swept under the rug, that weren't, that we were before maybe able to kind of like block out in the noise, and now with the silence, it's so apparent. And kind of it's happened to what you were saying before about relationships. We see that a lot. A lot of my work, I said, is within romantic relationships, and we've seen definitely heightened issues in that realm because people are forced to navigate their relationships different. They have a lot more time with their partners, a lot tighter spaces, and a lot fewer distractions. And so, they're forced to kind of navigate this new norm and deal with issues that they might have been able to distract themselves from before.
You know, it's a really interesting point. I remember when a COVID outbreak just started, I'd hear all these jokes that, you know, a lot of people, you know, lives were being destroyed sadly, but people were making the jokes, the two people that are going to come out of this better off were divorce lawyers and jewelers, because of the extra pressure that was added into marriages, husbands and wives spending way more time than they had previously with their kids, and all these struggles. I wonder, I mean, like you said, a lot of working relationships are, have you seen an uptick in couples therapy? I don't, have you, are there, have you, is there a trend with divorce going on, or has it actually strengthened relationships?
So I think you see both sides of the coin, but I would definitely say you would see greater issues. And I don't, and I'm not saying like necessarily issues that are bringing everyone into therapy, and I'll go back to that in a second. But I think, again, people are learning that they have to, they're just learning a totally different way of navigating their relationship. And it's bringing to light a lot of issues that were there before. And now there's a lot more space to have to sit in it, right? So like beforehand, people were going to jobs all day and tending to their children's needs in different ways and tending to the outside environment a lot of ways. And now it's like, well, we're working from home and maybe we're schooling from home. And so our whole world is kind of much smaller in our day to day because we're not leaving our homes. And so I think a lot of tension has increased in relationships, and it's a lot harder to kind of navigate those day to days. On the other hand, we are definitely seeing people having the opportunity to spend a lot more time with partners, right? So it's, you can see on the positive side, people are getting to spend time getting to know their partners in different ways. I think a lot of people are starting relationships during COVID, and they're going a bit faster in some ways because they just have a lot more time and fewer distractions to kind of put into that relationship, right? So there's not this like outside distraction, so they can really focus and be very present on the relationship itself. So I think that you definitely are seeing both sides of it. I would say it's, if I had to say or had to guess, I think it's been a little more on the difficult side because there's definitely an increase in stressors also overall, right? People are, we're navigating kind of a global stressor, which increases people's kind of individual stressors.
I want to definitely go into that, but I caught myself being under, just make catching a thought that I need to change, and that is, even if it has resulted in therapy that isn't necessarily
a negative, and it shouldn't be thought that mm-hmm. way. Very much mm-hmm. could be a positive. I wonder if this has actually caused, you know, people to go to therapy and has actually forced couples to work on it. When you go to therapy, you have you're going to a space that allows you to actually work on your relationship, and yeah. you know, I could be helping work through issues that had been underlying for years. That could have been a ticking time bomb that would have led to unfortunate situations. So the fact that this has maybe caused more therapy or people to actually relook at their relationships isn't necessarily, shouldn't be thought of as a negative at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I do think that that's actually a really good point in terms of, like, I think it created a situation that people didn't really have a choice, right? So now it's like your relationship's going to end because you have to address these issues. These issues are much more blatant, and they're much more challenging to navigate because we are so surrounded by people in our lives on a much greater scale, right? So again, like I said, working from home or just those changes. And so I don't think you could, I think whereas couples maybe beforehand, they could have avoided it or they could have learned to navigate without it. Now it's like, you know, either we engage in therapy or this isn't going to work and we sit in really true discomfort. So I think that's actually a good point. Something that's actually interesting to mention, you know, in terms of you're mentioning like trends and in terms of COVID, is that something that I've noticed specifically at the practice I'm at, but I think on a much broader level, is while there's definitely a larger need for therapy, there is, because of the economic issues and people's just kind of facing more economic difficulties and financial difficulties, people can't afford it in the same way as beforehand. So while there's a greater need, I actually think there's not necessarily an increase in people going to therapy because they don't necessarily have the money to go to therapy, which is really hard.
Yeah, the monetary part of therapy is something I think a lot about. It's definitely played a factor into whether I do or don't go to therapy. And I think it's a real problem that I don't know what the solution the solution is. I'm sure there are a lot of people that are a lot smarter than I am, but I do think that there are tools out there, hopefully, that are going to be created to guide that. But I think it's a really good point. Not only are people dealing with financial stress as it is really hard to handle, but now having to worry about being able to fit budget into to create your budget a space for you to go to therapy and spend on it. And people, unfortunately, I think one of the biggest stigmas that are left with mental health, and I'm sure there are a lot that other people may agree with me, but I think the stigma of thinking of mental health as opposed to just thinking as a part of health, right? We say physical health and mental health, and I think when we can start looking at mental health and consider it health, right? If you had if there are people out there who have injuries that don't go to the ER as well, but there's a physical injury and people look at it differently from a mental injury. And I'm curious when that shift is going to start to, people are going to start treating their mental health and what's going on with them the same way they will their physical.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's a really fine line, right? And I think it's something I've noticed, you know, on a personal level within people I know and whatnot. It's just like, there's a part of, right. So now we're obviously in a global health, right. A pandemic and crisis, but you know, isolating is obviously causing issues on a mental health level. And so what balance do we create in our lives? At what point do we attend to our mental health and prioritize that too? Right. Like we can't just isolate totally, and we need to like see people, and it's really hard. It's very hard to navigate when there is this like large health component, and at what point do we factor in our mental health and, you know, the role that that plays in just navigating even COVID.
Yeah, I think COVID has definitely been, COVID has kind of overshadowed everything. And I'm curious to hear from your perspective, what are some, I don't know, tips or strategies that people can use on a daily basis or on a more of an overview basis on how to help themselves and take care of their mental health?
During COVID specifically or overall?
Let's do both.
Okay, absolutely. I mean, listen, I think on creating practice and creating engaging in certain practices and creating routine, I would say, is always going to be helpful. So let's say like, you know, engaging in some kind of like mindfulness or meditative practice is always going to be helpful, especially in navigating like anxiety and trying to help us feel more present focus, right? So when we think about COVID, it was such a anxiety provoking thing for us because there was so much unknown regarding the future and what's going to be. So trying to engage in practices where we're grounding ourselves more and staying more present focused is going to be very helpful. So definitely like mindfulness practices. I know there's like good apps for it. Maybe like there's an app called like Headspace, or there are plenty of apps that people can start to engage in. Even like journaling, right? So thinking through, I know for myself, I've always been very partial. I did my dissertation on like the research surrounding gratitude. So I've always really felt like journaling and engaging in gratitude journals has always been very effective. There's so much research surrounding, you know, just like the impact of gratitude on just overall well-being and happiness and mental health and a lot of positive emotions. So I think journaling more broadly and definitely, you know, even gratitude journals are definitely effective. You know, I think I'm always a proponent of therapy, but that's obviously a little harder. It's always, you know, for some people to get, like we were saying, there's monetary issues that might get in the way of it or certain barriers. I think those are definitely two good places to start. I don't know if you have any.
Yeah, no, I gotta know more about the gratitude journal and what that encompasses. What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so there's definitely nowadays there are more set ones, and they're more like unstructured versus structured. When I say set, so like they have journals specifically for it. I'm partial to just like regular journaling. Let's say you wake up and you the first thing you do in the morning is write something you're grateful for, right? So saying like I'm grateful for, and I always try to tell clients or friends and whatnot, focus on things that are very basic, right? Because there's always a pressure surrounding like I need to be grateful for this like large thing. It could literally be I'm grateful for waking up in the morning. And I think, you know, obviously the times we're living in and this health focus, like that's not something small, right? And so getting into the practice and the mindset of starting our day like that, again, given the research on how effective gratitude is going to be something that's tremendously helpful. I do think it's hard because I've had plenty of clients that fall into this category when routines become too focused on and too much like pressured, it actually ends up backfiring. So you want to create an environment where it's like very low pressure, right? You want to maybe wake up and write something you're grateful for. You don't need to like get into these really extensive journaling, or you don't want to put so much pressure on your mindfulness or meditation practice that it becomes like I'm judging myself for not doing it, right? You want to be careful of those things that might come up in that process.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's a warning that I think applies to a lot of practices with when people put all their eggs in one basket and put all the weight of the world into one practice that they do, that if they, you know, wake up in the morning and they don't, and they break off from the routine, and people start, they kind of don't know what to do because they've put all their eggs in that basket. And once that collapses, they get stuck, and then the anxiety kicks in, thoughts start to ruminate.
Exactly. And then there's a lot of judgment of our emotions surrounding it. And then I'm like, well, at that point it's backfiring somewhat, right? Because we're seeing that we're trying to do it to help our anxiety. But if there's so much anxiety during the process, then maybe that's not something that's for you. Right. So it's kind of learning a lot of it as a little bit trial and error and trying to remove a little bit of the pressure that we often put on ourselves to be, you know, perfect in those areas, or a little bit of more of those perfectionistic tendencies.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that inhibit us from getting into it in the first place. The thought of myself doing a gratitude journal just creates incredible feelings of discomfort. The idea of writing down my thoughts and just that practice. Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of things, and instead of, you know, discounting it as a practice, I think I see so much merit in it, and going, maybe diving into that discomfort is a big part of the overview of how we deal with our mental health. So that's definitely something I know I'm going to be thinking about for my personal self.
I mean, you bring up an excellent point, right? So the idea of like sitting in discomfort, I think you should always have like a little bit of discomfort, because that's what's going to push us to want to grow. And that's what's going to push us to work through the things, right? Like asking ourselves like good questions of why, what about this is making me uncomfortable? Why is this anxiety provoking? You know, what could I do to kind of, you know, sit in this discomfort, work through some of this discomfort. Because ultimately, you know, the uncomfortable areas, if we can work through them, that's where our growth happens.
It's a very good point. And discomfort is something that I think a lot about. It's a big part of how I view my own mental health, and noticing moments where, you know, I can dive into discomfort. And people who I speak with, on and off the podcast, have all mentioned, you know, I've done exclusive podcasts, but the idea of just seeking discomfort, going after it, and really embedding themselves in it, and then the problem is, you also hear, the root of a lot of people's issues is that discomfort. It's a double, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say that there is, the root of it is the discomfort?
I think discomfort, when people sit in discomfort, I think it brings up, it allows them, puts them in a situation to, that can bring up a lot of uncomfortable thoughts or feelings, mm-hmm. or emotions going into that discomfort, whether it could be seeking discomfort in the sense of going, let's say you're not comfortable with travel and you book mm-hmm. a spontaneous trip. The moments, yeah. the anxiety, some people, you know, who break through that and are able to go through that and end up going on the trip and embracing it, you know, those are the stories that people hear. You don't often hear the stories where people then try it and fail.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that failure could be part of the process. I think that, again, sitting in our discomfort is where the growth happens and is where the root of the work is done. I also think at the end of the day, it's like, and this is where kind of therapy comes into it, is like, you really do need the tools to navigate it. So if you're kind of doing it on your own and you really don't have those tools, you know, how are you kind of working through that discomfort? Is it going to be effective? Is it going to be ineffective? Right. And so having those tools and understanding and having maybe someone ask you those hard questions that help you navigate those rougher waters is really what's going to be essential.
How do we create healthy relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the root of it, and it's kind of what we spoke about before, is this idea of effective communication. And so to break that down a bit, something that I focus on a lot within, you know, my clinical work and with clients is like, what is effective communication? Something, you know, I often speak about is this idea of, I think at least, is like breaking down defenses that are going to naturally come up. And so focusing, let's say, on like I statements versus you statements. So for instance, let's say we want to communicate our needs and we're trying to talk to someone. And so rather than saying like, you keep doing this wrong, it's saying like, I need X, Y, and Z. So we want to focus on like I statements versus you statements. That's definitely something that's helpful in terms of effective communication. I think the ability to like listen to our partners or family members and take responsibility is super important in building healthier relationships. So, right. So it's when we're breaking down those defenses, it's ability to say like, yes, like maybe I do take responsibility, or maybe that is something I've done wrong. How could I do something different? I think something about healthy relationships that always comes up is the idea of always continuing to be curious, right? So let's say we think about romantic relationships. It's being curious about our partners, delving into their needs and their wants and their interests and desires, right? We want to know about our partners. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, Doctors John and Julie Gottman, right? They speak a lot about the idea of really like healthy relationships and romantic partners. They have a friendship. They've built admiration and fondness. And so you need to have these aspects within relationships in order to navigate conflicts. You need to be able to have these foundations. So these can be applied to really any relationships, right? You need to have a certain foundation of I'm here for you. I'm listening to you. I'm showing up for you. And therefore, we can manage conflict more effectively. I don't know if that's something that does that.
Yeah, wow. That, there's a lot to unpack there. There's a few things that stuck out to me. And those were you versus I statements. Can you give an example of what a you and I statement is?
Yeah, absolutely. So a you versus I, like I was saying before, would be like, let's say I'm really frustrated because my partner is really messy and he never cleans the kitchen. So I can say, like, you never clean the kitchen. You're always such a mess. And so you're kind of like, your partner is going to hear that as in a very attacking language, right? It's very like, you don't do anything right. Rather than saying like, you know, it would be really helpful for me if the kitchen was clean. I would really love it if you clean the kitchen. So you're coming at it versus saying like, this is something in need of my own. And so you can't, your partner can't really, it's very subjective, right? There's nothing like, they can't say like, no, you don't. They can't like, they can't object to what you're saying because it's your subjective experience of it. And it's a non-defensive approach. So like, I would like that. And so here I am showing up to you. How could you help me meet my needs? Rather than saying like, you are doing something wrong. And I find that, you know, especially within couples work, is that partners are much more receptive when their partner kind of uses more of these I statements, because again, it eliminates the defenses that are naturally going to come up when your partner feels accused.
Right. You're kind of breaking, you're mm-hmm.
you're de-escalating a situation that could be easily escalated, and not going at it in an attacking manner. You're stating something that you need versus what you want, or putting the onus on the other person. I would also want to just state that I feel like what could happen, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if this is the healthy response, but if somebody said that, I just think the logical response back would be then clean it up. Like if I said, I need the kitchen clean, then when the partner could respond, I feel like this might not be a healthy response, but one that's kind of common. Then you clean it up. I just realized it out loud as I'm saying.
Well, and that's a good point. Well, so then it could be phrased differently, right? Like it would mean a lot for me if the kitchen was clean and you would take on some of that responsibility. It would be really important to me, right? So you're even saying like, or I would really love it if you helped me in cleaning the kitchen right now. And so there's less of this, again, attacking language. And so the language, I always say the language we use is so important. It's really like, and you made a really good point, right? So it softens the startup. It doesn't escalate. You were saying it de-escalates. Like how we start a conversation is extremely important to how the rest of the conversation is going to go. And so if we can soften that startup and we, you know, go into it by eliminating those defenses and working with our partner to kind of eliminating those accusation pieces, they recognize, hey, actually, look, my partner is with me in this. I'm not against you. This isn't me versus you. This is me with you. And this is me trying to build this deeper connection by telling you what my needs are. And it's super important for me to be heard in this moment. So you see how it can kind of come across differently if I'm saying like, I'm with you in this. I just need you to hear me out versus that like us versus them of like, you're doing this wrong. I can't believe you would do this to me.
Right. One is scoreboard. Feels like you're putting like on a scoreboard. Mm-hmm. Like you didn't clean up. Like you need to clean up as if you need to catch up or as if it's all on you as opposed to in a partnership. You're stating your needs and then they can meet you with their needs. And there's a creating a bridge to really connect as well and to communicate. And I think what you said is 100% true. The language and the words that we choose are so important. Every syllable, every vowel, every letter that we use is a way for us to communicate. And it's not, it's usually not by accident, the words that we choose to use. So if we're not mindful of it and conscious of it, a lot of things can slip out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think something that's interesting that I did hear is kind of in line with what we're saying is this idea of also, you know, within our language is focusing on positive needs. So what I mean when I say positive needs is this idea of like, let's say again, we're going to go back to the example with the kitchen. If your partner is really messy, you can say, you can focus on what you don't want or what you do want. So I can say, I would love for you to clean the kitchen. That's a positive need versus I hate it when you don't do this or when you're not cleaning the kitchen, it really frustrates me. And that's focusing on the negative side of it. And so I mean, from a personal standpoint, I think when we focus on positive needs, it's empowering in some way. It feels like we're allowing our partner to know there's something that can be done. It feels like, you know, we have hope in that their ability to do it versus if we're focusing on the negative, it feels a bit more hopeless to me. It feels like we're taking away that power. We're highlighting their inability to achieve something.
Wow. I'm just thinking, it's running in my head, life examples in my past, you know, present and what I can do in the future to be better at using my language in terms of conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. You would be surprised by how such small changes go a very long way. And so even when I work with couples or even an individual, you know, within individual therapy, you know, just starting with basic tools of like I versus you or softening startups or, you know, certain things like that, those little changes that they start to make actually go a very long way. You know, they feel a lot more, again, they're able to navigate some of these conflicts a bit more effectively than in the past.
And I have a sneaking suspicion that just making that one small change will have ripple effects across once you understand the concept and apply it. Will have ripple effects on other aspects of your life outside of even the relationship when you understand the power.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's not just, it's a tool to be used within any relationship. It's definitely not just a romantic relationship. It's any, I think, you know, with parents or siblings or, you know, friends or any kind of, you know, within the work setting, just the ability to kind of hone in on our own needs and what the I is versus like, more of that like blaming language or accusatory language that again, people are very defensive, and our natural instinct is to go into a defensive mode. And so when we can eliminate that from the start, or we can at least try to reduce it, we have a much better likelihood of kind of getting through a more effective conversation. And you know what, at the end of the day, getting our own needs met, because that's the purpose of it, right?
Right. I think that actually goes, you know, full circle to what we spoke about in the beginning, by taking care of yourself first and prioritizing yourself. And an example would be using that language as a way to take care of yourself. You're better. Mm-hmm. You're going to be better suited and better off with affecting and helping other people.
Absolutely. And if we're able to, you know, it's a great point, because if we're able to convey that to our partners without our partners getting defensive, our partners ultimately are the ones that are going to benefit, right? If we're happier and we feel like our needs are met, how much more so are we going to be able to show up for our partners in an effective way, right?
Absolutely.
So it's like, if we could eliminate the defense, and our partner won't think of it as like my spouse or partner or girlfriend, boyfriend is against me, rather they're with me, and how could I help meet their needs? We're going to be happier as a unit. They're going to be able to show up for me in a more effective way. We're going to be happier as a dyad, right? So how can we get to that more effective language? And so it's interesting.
And what's stopping us from, as a society or people on an individual level, like what are the common things that prevent us from doing this?
Well, I think it's people don't have the tools. So people aren't even necessarily aware of it. I always say, even within therapy, I say insight is half of the battle in a way, right? Just not understanding patterns, communications, the way we operate and navigate, you know, is half of it. And I think ultimately, kind of what I said before, you know, our defenses get so high. We're so much more inclined to protect ourselves than to want to like work through it. And so when we go into a protective mode, we're often not so receptive to, you know, what comes next. And so I always say, if we can eliminate some of that earlier on, we're going to have a much more successful and effective conversation.
I wonder, is there an aspect of fear of like rejection that causes it? Like if I'm the one who starts it, then at least it's or like there's a reason why it ends, or there's a rejection aspect to it.
Oh, I think in general, right, with when I say like protection with defenses, there's always going to be some fear of like rejection. So we protect ourselves immediately, right? We want to feel like we have this upper hand, or protecting ourselves in case of like, we don't know what's going to come next. Yeah. And so it's fairly vulnerable, right, to say like to take responsibility and say, I'm here, I've done something wrong, or not even done something wrong, like I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm recognizing that it's not in line with like your needs and what you want. It's a very vulnerable place to be. And it's the shift we really ultimately need, is to be able to take more responsibility and to be able to listen more intently, right? Because I go back to what I was saying before, it's like, we're all going to benefit more from it, yourself included. If you listen, you take constructive feedback, and you're able to kind of like hear stuff about yourself in that effective way, like you're going to be in better relationships. And you're also going to be, you know, you can grow from it, because you're going to be already in that more growth mindset. And, you know, you can take what you hear and work on yourself in some way.
Wow. And you used a word that I think a lot of people know and a lot of people struggle with, and that's vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What is vulnerability?
It's the ability to show up without knowing what the outcome's going to be. And so it's. What's interesting is that I've heard a lot of someone that I really like within the field, Brené Brown. She talks a lot about vulnerability and shame. She's a shame researcher, and she talks a lot about vulnerability. And, you know, what's interesting I always hear is it's not just about like disclosure, right? So like, it's not about like telling any random person something about yourself. It's knowing kind of who your audience is, and it's showing up without knowing what the outcome is going to be. We don't know what's going to happen next, and we're still going to show up regardless. And it's absolutely going to induce some fear and anxiety. And yet we're going to show up despite it.
Wow. Vulnerability has been something that I personally have been obsessed with and trying to learn and to understand and to figure out. And I've read Brené Brown. I've read Darren Greatly. I've listened to her speak podcast, and I never fully understood it until you broke it down. That's like the best explanation of vulnerability I've ever heard.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. No, I love her work, and I think she does a really good job of talking through it. But you know, you're right. It is a buzzword, but it's a very real, and it's very scary for a lot of us, right? And it stops us from engaging in things that we would otherwise engage in, or help us to kind of get to a place in our life that we want to be in. Because we're scared of what's going to come next. And yet we have to kind of learn to sit in some of that fear. We talked about before, sit in that discomfort and show up anyway. Allow ourselves to allow ourselves to be vulnerable.
Wow. I think the example, you know, of showing up to the arena, not knowing the outcome, like not knowing what's going on. I think that's it. It's not spewing out, telling your story to a stranger. I mean, that's could be a good aspect of it, but that's, there's no vulnerability. There's not really any stakes there. There's not.
I love the way she talks about it. The idea of like, it's a lot scarier to not show up at the end of the day, right? Like, if you get to the end of your life and you don't show up, that should be a lot scarier for us. And I think people need to kind of sit with that idea more. Like, yeah, right now in this moment, is it scary? Sure. But isn't it scarier to get to the end of your life and to not, you know, have had a certain conversation with somebody, have not engaged in a certain relationship, have not taken a risk within a certain job or and whatnot? It's scarier. It's going to make us feel a lot more incomplete at the end of the day, or a lot less, you know, we haven't taken those risks. So what does it mean right now to sit in that discomfort if it means we've lived a more whole and complete life?
Wow. And if that should be the goal, that should be what we're working on and trying to do. And through that, we do it by creating relationships, right? Friends, family, personal relationships all go into it. And anxiety and fear and life, what life throws at us, all goes into it. But the goal at the end of the day is to embrace it and to live in that discomfort until that discomfort feels, you know, you've learned to be okay in it. And once you learn to kind of be okay in it, then you kind of understand that there's nothing to fear but that fear itself.
Absolutely. It's very in line with a lot of the work I do. I do a lot of work within acceptance and commitment therapy. And so the whole idea of the type of therapy is based in the notion of, you know, we want to live more value-driven, meaningful lives. And how do we do that? We learn to accept and to, you know, separate from some of these like dysfunctional thoughts and emotions that are getting in the way of it. So a lot of it's surrounding the idea of like, how can we sit with the discomfort surrounding, let's say, anxiety, if it means we're still moving towards our values and moving towards living a meaningful life. And that's ultimately what it's about. It's learning to kind of recognize that having uncomfortable emotions, such as, let's say, anxiety or sadness, are part of what it means to be human. And it's okay to have those emotions, and it's okay. We don't need to judge that experience. We should allow it to be, because part of that and allowing it to exist, we can move towards and continue to move towards what we want to do in our lives. We don't want to allow it to stop us. It's I think a lot of people don't understand. It's like, these negative emotions, it's essentially part of what it means for us to be human. And so it's okay for it to exist. It's okay to make room for it.
Are there things that are messages going on in society or in our cultures that are leading to negative, like that are stopping us from getting there? Or is it all just part of the human experience?
Well, I do think there's messages surrounding what it means to experience negative emotions, right? We're so averse to it. There's so many messages surrounding happiness and being happy and wanting that to be the only thing we can sit in. But at the end of the day, it doesn't make the other emotions go away. It just creates a greater struggle surrounding them. It creates a greater need to say, anxiety is not allowed to exist. Sadness is not allowed to exist. We push so hard. And when we push so hard, it actually makes them worse. And so, yeah, I do think there are messages around like, we only want to be sitting in these happy emotions when, you know, I do think there's a need to really embrace all of it, embrace the whole human experience and the whole gamut, right? We can't just feel positive emotions. We'd have to give that up if it meant we couldn't feel negative emotions. So how can we kind of work towards feeling all of them and not pushing it away? And that'll help us to kind of move, work on moving towards, you know, living a more value-driven, meaningful life. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. It leads me to a thought that I've been working on and understanding the relationship of what happiness is. And I think I came into right now in this moment thinking happiness is just the absence of sadness, and sadness was the absence of happiness, where I'd only know if I was happy after it was gone when I was sad, and then understanding, oh, that was happiness, or and vice versa. Mm-hmm. That's what sadness was. And now I understand that it's not totally right. I think there's a relation. There's what you said is that there's really a relationship between happiness and sadness and emotions that have opposites or inverses, where you can't, how would you know what happiness was without sadness?
Yeah.
You wouldn't.
Absolutely. And something within acts is that we often say, like, well, you could either, you know, you often will say to clients, like, you could either have all the emotions or none of them. And so, like, when you think about it like that, you'd have to give up, you know, like, feelings. Again, there's some spectrum of it. Like you're saying, you have to understand happiness through understanding sadness. And so would you want to give up all the positive emotions if it meant just to not have sad emotions? No, we want to feel those things too, right? I think ultimately most people wouldn't give up positive emotions just to give up negative emotions. Yeah. It would be hard to give up those positive experiences. Like, we want to know what it feels like to feel happy and to feel connected and satisfied and all these things within our relationships on a personal level, and just, you know, get more of that meaning through that. And so, you know, it's more required.
Yeah, it's really sad. I think that unfortunately are people, and I know myself, I've been at a point and points, and I know I've spoken to people who've been at points in their life where they've said, it's fine, shut the emotions off. I'd rather live a neutral life. And that never really lasts, because that neutral life doesn't allow you to reach those happy points. It stops you from connecting and allowing yourself to feel. And then when you do start to, you know, open yourself up again and understand that there is actual downside, but that downside comes upside. If you can feel, and if it's all on a scale of 1 to 10 and you only limit yourself to feel between a 4 and a 6, and then you open your, or just a 5, whatever your scale is, and you open yourself up to, if you can feel a 3, that means you can also feel a 7.
Absolutely. There's so little, like, meaning and value and growth in that, like, complete neutrality, right? There's not much movement. And so where are you going in your life? Where is that meaning? And I do think also, you know, in terms of, like, more negative emotions, there's a tremendous amount of growth and work that can be done in that space. And yeah, it's really hard. We don't want to have to think that we have to sit in that space to grow and to learn. But there's a tremendous, if you're willing and open, there's a ton of work and value in that space.
That's so insightful, because if you don't, right? People spend their lives and time avoiding the negatives, right? They just want to be happy all the time. They're optimist, absolutist, and they're always happy, happy, happy all the time. But the work and the growth is done in the negative. So if you need to have... you need to have some agreement or at least a relationship with your negative, with the negatives, or maybe you change your perspective at all and don't even label them as negative. You just look at them as emotions or feelings.
And it's using that as an opportunity, which again is a lot easier said than done. And it is definitely challenging. But it, you know, using that as an opportunity to learn more about yourself and to dive deeper and to really, you know, gain from that challenging space and that discomfort that we spoke about before.
Yeah, I think ultimately it all ties together inside our own heads and our own emotions, our own hearts, and everything about us. As I wrap up, I do want to give you the floor to, if there are any final thoughts that we touched on so many topics, thoughts that you wanted to express. I want to give you the floor now to speak.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just want to thank you, obviously, for having me and for obviously creating a platform to just talk about various mental health topics. I think it's so important, obviously, to, you know, break down the stigma surrounding some of these things and, you know, provide a space and hopefully where people could, you know, learn more about themselves and guide them towards navigating some of these issues that do come up for them. So I want to thank you, obviously, for reaching out and for giving me that opportunity to kind of talk through some of these topics. And yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Thank you. I just want to thank you. I appreciate the compliment. I'm just so grateful that I was able to create a platform to space that to give you a platform to speak, because clearly you have such an incredible command on all these topics. I'm completely blown away, and you've given me so much to think about. And I want to ask you, where can people find you or get access to your work if they're interested in setting up appointments or just to,
yeah, absolutely. I as you mentioned earlier on, there's obviously my Instagram account. So people who are more social media savvy, so my platform is Dr. Gabrielle Pazalski. So that we can kind of put the link in if you want.
Absolutely.
So people can definitely always DM me through that account. I also, you know, I work at a practice, Thriving Center of Psychology, so people can always reach out to me through my practice. And I'm always happy, and I always say during, like, I offer a free consultation. So I always say, like, you know, even if it's not a good fit, I'm always happy to provide people information on referrals or helping them kind of get more, you know, just started in the process and you know, kind of gain some of that guidance. Because I really do recognize that starting therapy and starting the process can be really overwhelming and really daunting, and just not an easy process always. So I'm always happy to even just provide that space to, you know, help people provide, you know, help people gain referrals or just navigate those initial stages or, you know, some of the uncertainty that comes in the beginning stages. So, you know, I'm here and I would love to be a resource in any way that I can be.
Wow. I highly recommend, I will put all links to connect to you in the show notes below.
Thank you.
And access to, I recommend anyone out there who's interested in learning more, please reach out. Thank you so much, Dr. Podolsky, for coming on.
Thank
you so much to Dr. Podolsky for coming onto the podcast. If you're interested in reaching out, you can find her at her Instagram, Dr._Gabriella_Podolsky, or on her email, dr.podolsky@thrivingcenterofpsych.com. I will put links in the show notes below. If anybody out there is interested in coming onto the podcast, please reach out at don'tworryaboutitpodcast@gmail.com or through my Instagram, Don't Worry About It Podcast, or the Facebook page. Thank you guys so much for listening. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, and I'll see you next week.